You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, friends. I'm back again. I love doing this podcast, man. Welcome back to the New Evangelicals podcast. Okay, this episode, I have Ben Kramer. I just did the interview. I wanted to do this intro video now while it's fresh in my mind. I'm not sure what I'm going to label this episode yet, but one of my current thoughts is labeling this episode the Evangelical Manifesto, because Ben brings to life the history of the early evangelical movement, and it's probably a history you never heard of before. And spoiler alert, it looks nothing like the current version of evangelicalism in America. So Ben and I kind of do a big, you know, surface 10,000 foot view of some of the big names in the evangelical movement, what they stood for, what they were actively fighting against. And at the end of the episode, we kind of talk about how we kind of got to where we are today. But this is definitely an episode where I have to have Ben back to go deeper, because truly, friends, there's so much here. And to know that we stand on such solid ground as people who have come before us in the evangelical tradition, to me, just gives me life. So I really hope that you enjoy this episode. That being said, I just want to say, as always, thank you to everyone who is sharing this podcast, sharing the episodes. If you're watching on YouTube and you subscribe, thank you so much. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts or Spotify, thank you so much. It is a huge help whenever people share this podcast. So if this episode speaks to you, if you can share it on your story or on a post or share it to a friend and give this episode a review and a rating on Apple Podcasts or on YouTube, it would just be a ginormous help to us. I'm so grateful for everyone who has done that. Also, don't forget, if you want to get more involved, we can always use financial support. The New Evangelicals is completely crowdsourced. We don't do paywalls. We don't do anything behind some kind of fee. Everything we offer is totally free to our audience and to our community. So if you feel like giving money might be good, we'll take it. So I would love that. That'd be just super helpful. It covers all of our costs, our Zoom, you know, the stuff I say all the time, the website, our social media stuff, my time, all that good stuff. So the link is in the show notes or in the description below. And yeah, friends, without further ado, check out this episode with Ben. I hope you enjoy it. Ben, we're doing this again. You know, I don't know if people understand the story between you and I, because I discovered you, not that I didn't discover you in the sense of like a manager discovers raw talent. I'm saying I found you. All right, let's restart this. Oh my goodness. Okay, let me restart. Ben! I want to tell the story though. It's a good story. So I found you on Facebook. I mean, it had to be close to a year ago now. And yeah. I was like, oh shoot. I like this guy, this Ben guy, this Benjamin dude. He's saying some good stuff. I liked it. And then I like added you as a friend. I was always like, dude, I love what this guy says. I think it's so good. And then I forgot how, but somehow I think I reached out to you. And I said, yo, dude, do you want to come on my podcast, which at the time was my old podcast, the Coffee Theology and Jesus podcast.
Right.
Yes. Right. And you came on. And you
were the OG.
And we had this great conversation. I remember being there like, oh my goodness, like this guy knows his stuff. I can listen to him talk all day. And then our friendship out of that, that's how our friendship was born.
Seriously, it's been awesome. It really has been.
And now we're in a group chat with some other people. It's great.
Yeah. And I've just been an admirer of you and your work since the beginning too, just to see how New Evangelicals has taken off and what God's been doing with that, like creating a space for people who feel safe enough to air their doubts and their critiques and their questions. Like that's a space that's really needed in the church. So I think we're just fangirling on each other.
The audience is like vomiting, like, all right, guys, get over it. All right, we're done hearing you. It's like when celebrities are like, no, you're the better celebrity. No, you're the better celebrity. It's like, oh, I'm going to vomit. So enough of that. So Ben, let's do this. We have a lot to get to in this episode. I've asked you on this episode for a specific reason, but before we hop into it, give us the quick journey. Like, what's your background? What did you study? What are you doing now? Give us that background for everyone here.
Sure. So I began my pursuit of pastoral ministry in college age. I got a degree in Christian ministry. And in the midst of that, I fell in love with history and philosophy. And so I went on to get a master's in what's called spiritual formation. And no, it's not a Hogwarts degree, I promise. It really looks at how spirituality is formed within the individual. And it takes philosophical notions of human nature and things like that. But then I really wanted to pursue church history. And so that was my next master's degree. And I looked at church history from like year 100 to the 21st century. So that's a really long timeline.
Yeah.
Just looking at some of the overall big picture factors there. And I've just had such a deep love and craving for history ever since. And so I did my focus mostly on the Enlightenment period because I saw how much that impacts 19th and 21st century Christianity, especially in the American context. And so that's where I kind of have been giving a lot of my focus academically. In the pastoral sense, I've seen that impact my ministry as well, where I can kind of connect some of those historical factors that is contributing to the church movement today.
Cool. I love that. You know, it's interesting. I've always been personally a more like futuristic thinker, but the past maybe 5 or 6 years, I've kind of had this, I'll say amateur fascination with history because I'm realizing that there really is nothing new under the sun. And we can really trace back a lot of the foundational beginnings that got us to where we are now, especially in America with the evangelical movement. And I found it just so interesting and also so helpful to know that, like, you know, some of my hunches are either way off or they're correct. And history is a great way of doing that.
Absolutely.
So, you know, one of the things that I've gotten critiqued over, and it's a fair critique, is, you know, some people are like, listen, Tim, I understand you have this New Evangelicals thing, but why New Evangelicals? You know, like evangelicalism, it's like nationalists, and right now it's really gross, and they all like Tucker Carlson, and you know, like what, you know, they're just kind of like, evangelicalism now stands for things that I don't think it stood for in the beginning. And I would always say, like, listen, you know, I understand that. And to be fair, I didn't know this history till recently. So at the time, I would say I hear that. But I just think that, you know, like the idea of an evangelical, someone who proclaims good news, that's worth trying to at least reclaim or save in some way, shape, or form. So you're the one actually who told me, Tim, this book, Discovering an Evangelical Heritage, it's a must read. So I picked it up for like $4, okay? It's like 110 pages.
Wow. Yeah, it's awesome.
It's such an easy read.
Yeah.
And the author, I'm blanking on his name. What's the author's name?
Donald Dayton.
Thank you. He says in the book, I think he's writing like in the 1960s. He's like, listen, there's a fundamentalist takeover happening in evangelicalism. Let's go back to our roots. I'm like, this sounds familiar. So I know this is kind of like one of your expertise. Can you kind of give us what is the formation of the evangelical? I've heard stories of evangelicalism was formed over being pro-slavery, but in the book, you know, Discovering an Evangelical Heritage, he talks about how it was really founded on abolitionism. So can you kind of give us some of these elements that are happening that kind of form the evangelical movement?
Sure. And before I begin, just give a caveat. I'm not a like a traditional historian. I really want to become that. Yeah. But like Kristen Dumas, who wrote right. Jesus and John Wayne, like Donald Dayton, these are historians, right? Okay. I have a deep love and passion for it as a pastor. And so, you know, before I say anything, right. I hope that it's an invitation to go read those people, right?
Sure, sure.
We're doing incredible academic work. This is kind of an appetizer to like wet your whistle and to go and get more deeply involved in that history.
Alrighty.
But some of the things that I've found in early evangelicalism is how you cannot separate the movement from what's happening in broader society. So one of the elements, and there's so much, history is so complicated and complex,
yeah.
but I think some of the highlights can really help us at least get a start in understanding some of those movements. One of the things, so we've all heard of like the first and second Great Awakening, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So the first Great Awakening happens, the spiritual fervor in American life, but both of those awakenings have that element, that identity, a spiritual awakening in the American religious atmosphere that overtakes the country. It's just an incredible wide sweeping awakening. What happens though, is both of those awakenings happen prior to a massive anxiety, and they're byproducts of a massive anxiety in the nation. So the first Great Awakening happens right before the Revolutionary War. So you have this breaking away from British rule. All of these questions about who we are as a nation are on the forefront of everyone's minds.
And what year are we here? What year are we talking about?
So like, Revolutionary War is like early, you know, late 1700s, right?
Cool.
And then the second Great Awakening happens right before the Civil War. Hmm. So 1800s to late 1800s, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And so you're seeing this massive renewal and questions about authority. Authority is really the central point for both awakenings.
Hmm.
Now, and I want to, for the sake of our purposes for our podcast today, I want to look at the second Great Awakening the most, because that's really where you can find some of the strongest roots to evangelicalism. And evangelicalism, just a basic definition, is those who want to evangelize, to bring about the gospel message to the people. They're not keeping it to themselves. They're actually embodying that in the culture, right? So they're not an insular people. They really are breaking out into the streets and preaching this message of salvation in Christ.
So one question for you, just so I have my timeline right, because I'm not good with dates or timelines.
Sure.
So I'm going to, you know, explain it to me like I'm five. But up until the Second Great Awakening, are there self-identified evangelicals in society at this point? Or is that not even really a term that we see being used?
Yeah, the more, and people can correct me on this if I'm wrong, the more that I study this, the more I'm finding that evangelicalism is a term that historians use to describe this specific movement. But they do emphasize evangelism. So they're using that word. We are to evangelize, right? Mm-hmm. Evangelizing the person, the heart, the soul. That is a definite foundational term for what people, they would know themselves as revivalists, like Charles Finney,
yes,
who's one of the founders of evangelicalism. They would know themselves as revivalists during that time.
Okay. That's helpful.
So, great question there. But this question of authority is so central to the movement, because one of the things that's happening there, of course, is this dialogue over slavery, right? And how central it is to American life. And when you have a Protestant movement, right, that is already questioning Catholicism of Britain, you are fundamentally asking those questions of authority in regards to every aspect of life. And so you have Charles Finney coming along and saying, hey, if we are not to be have any allegiance except for to Jesus, then we can't have women have their first allegiance to men in marriage. It has to be to Jesus first, and men
dang.
Have their allegiance to Jesus first. So there you go. Like the first movement for women's suffrage and abolition there, people, no matter the color of their skin, shouldn't have their first allegiance to a slave owner. And so of course, revivalists are like, hey, that is in direct violation to the direct allegiance we're supposed to have to Jesus. So they became anti-slavery right away, right? They became anti owning women as property in marriage, and they became anti capitalist, really. They became the forerunners for unionists. Some of the richest evangelicals, like Lewis Tuppen, he is an incredible figure to look into for a wealthy early evangelical who was a reformer. But he was a silk merchant, and he made $1 million with his brother. He made $1 million a year in the mid 1800s. So that's incredible. And he was the primary figure in freeing the inhabitants of the slave ship Amistad, which the Steven Spielberg movie does not highlight at all. Mm. They make John Quincy Adams the star of the movie, when actually Lewis Tuppen was the evangelical Christian who led to setting that ship free and bringing the inhabitants back to Africa.
Wow.
Because advocated violating all the slave laws of the time, right? And he funded, he bankrolled it all.
So this guy is like, he's like the V for Vendetta, like bank at this point, you know? we're gonna fund the rebellion, because this is just wrong.
Exactly, because they deeply believed that putting anything above your allegiance to Christ was a sin that would impact all of society. And so they were so pragmatic on reforming society, and ironically, given what we hear today as our view of a Christian nation,
right?
That was actually why they did that. They wanted to see society become more Christian, but they did that through reforming oppressive systems over those who, especially those who oppressed the poor, the marginalized, and women.
Let me make sure I hear you. So you're saying that early evangelicals were godless socialist Marxists who wanted to destroy America and ruin everything via CRT. Is that correct?
Oh, absolutely. They were woke. They actually called themselves woke during that time. No, I'm just kidding.
So very heavy social focus, though. Like right out of the gate. It's like, hey, we should help reform society to be better.
Right. And to keep in mind, in this historical context, you don't have words like capitalism floating around. You don't have words like socialism. Communism wasn't even an idea you don't have Karl Marx, like the Soviet Union. None of these things that we would talk about today that we would fear is actually in the mindset of that time. And so these things would take more of a theological debate on what are we becoming as a society, right? Who are we becoming as Christians in this society?
Yeah.
And we need to take, it was so optimistic. They were so positive that with this awakening, we could actually make this a utopian society where everyone is actually free, no matter their sex, no matter the color of their skin, no matter their place in society, whether rich or poor, we could all work towards the good of each other in this culture. Like, that's loving your neighbor, right? That was an essential part of their movement.
Right.
Interestingly enough, have you heard of the movement of spiritualism during this time?
Vaguely.
So spiritualism was a massive movement that was even more extreme in reforming society, in that they bypassed the authority of scripture and the church to connect directly to the dead. So they would hold seances. They would have these wrappings around the house where they could hear and communicate with the dead. Abraham Lincoln and his wife actually were big spiritualists. They would bring them in to talk to their dead kids and things like that. But that was widespread, and it focused on Black women and white women who were young as the forerunners of that movement, because they fit this picture of purity in the culture. This like idea where God and the spirits could actually communicate through these pure virgins, the best in society. And so they actually led this abolitionist movement. And Frederick Douglass actually published a huge swath of their work in his newspaper because of this incredible awakening in the spiritualist movement. So like, if you wanted to offshoot all authority, what better way than just to connect to the dead and the spirits of those who left behind? They would hold seances with Benjamin Franklin and Thomas Jefferson and say, hey, these guys are talking to us now. And so you need to listen. Need to listen to the reforms that they're bringing about.
When you say that word spiritualism, in our context, I think of like New Ageism, you know, things like that. Sure. Are you talking about like spiritualism in the context of Christianity, or is this like its own thing?
So it's its own thing that actually uses a lot of Christian tenets.
Interesting.
And it did evolve into what we know as this New Age movement today, like separate from that. Okay. But many, many Christians, like Abraham Lincoln, you know, like Protestants, would be involved in the spiritualist movement. And that was actually a side product of the Great Awakening, which is why I mentioned it. So like, it's all going on at the same time. What Protestant Christians would call revival, spiritualists would call spiritual fervor. Right. So that whole dialogue is going on in the midst of. So it's an interesting way of seeing what kind of reforms were going on. They had these same purposes, though, of seeing women set free from these legal caste societies that would literally treat them like property.
Right.
And the same with slavery as well as the economy that would just bulldoze the poor.
Now, in the grand scheme of what's happening in the culture in like the 1800s, is this still seen as like a, almost like a fringe radical movement? Because slavery is widespread, it's popular, right? Women, being second class citizens is kind of the dominant viewpoint. So there has to be a Protestant, or I should say a Christian movement, that's also saying we're opposed to what these crazy revivalists are doing. Yeah. Is that true?
You're absolutely right. So the growth of this, just pat yourself on the back. The growth of this movement is alongside this dominating movement of what's called old school Calvinism. And old school Calvinism led to the founding of one of the biggest institutions of the time, which was Princeton University.
Yes, okay.
And they were producing missionaries and pastors at the time that were just infiltrating the landscape with this very reformed, very predestined, centered theology of old school Calvinism. And they absolutely despised the Charles Finneys and the abolitionists. What's his name? Charles Hodge.
Yes.
He's a prominent figure in the Princeton University. And he said that Christianity was never designed to uproot institutions and tear down America. You can't attack something. He literally said, you can't attack something so fundamental to the way America works, which is slavery.
Wow.
That is God's will. It's predestined to be this way.
Right. It's written.
Exactly. So for you to question that institution and America, which is God's chosen land, you are questioning God. And so Christianity isn't meant to tear those things apart. It's meant to live within them until Christ returns.
Wow. And this makes more sense because, as I read that book, Discovering an Evangelical Heritage, the author is kind of hinting at these things. He talks about Princeton and about Hodge and just how they really look down on these revivalists. And I think part of that is because, and again, tell me if I'm wrong, there seems to be this, at least perception in the culture, that these old school Calvinists are more intellectual and these revivalists are just more like almost backwoods a little bit. Is that the case?
Yeah. And I think that's the reputation they gain because of their questioning of authority. For example, George Whitefield and several other itinerant preachers were actually taking to preaching in fields, which was a brand new thing, instead of like church halls, which is the traditional norm, right? So when you have people like putting up tents like Charles Finney and having these tent revival meetings in the Great Awakening, well, old school Calvinists would say, no, like spiritual activity only takes place in the church sanctuary around the sacraments around the church table, right? You can't have preaching separate from that. And so they get this sort of backwoods hillbilly reputation because they're bucking the authority of what was, right?
Right.
And so, and it gets really messy from there. The founder of Oberlin College.
Yes, I want to get to Oberlin.
Oberlin College is doing the exact opposite, where, you know, they are accepting women at the same rate they're accepting men, people of color, from the beginning. And they become a place on the Underground Railroad for people to break the laws of the land to be freed from slavery on the way up to Canada, right?
I think it's so important to mention this because we're in such a culture now where law and order is key. You don't break the law. But these early evangelicals recognized how unjust the law was and said, no. If our allegiance is to a risen king, then these laws must be reformed. And no, we will. What's the word I'm looking for? It's like civil disobedience, right? Like, we're not going to be violent. However, we are going to resist, and we are going to do what we can for the people who are literally being oppressed right now.
Right. Yeah. There was a beautiful article I love where an early feminist who, her name is Mrs. Stone, and she became the laughingstock of mainstream Christianity of that time. Huh. She published in her paper on her wedding day that was signed by both her and her husband, that this marriage is not an institution where I become property.
Yes,
right.
Yes.
And she's like, I am not the property of my husband, and my husband needs to understand that we are equal in this relationship. And we are going to be an example that we are not going to abide by that marriage law of the day publicly.
Right.
Like, you talk about the repercussions and what we would call persecution today. Fellow Christians like, who's the guy we talked about with Amistad, Lewis Tappan. He, in the midst of the Amistad case, his Christian neighbors came and drug all of his furniture out of his house and set it on fire in the middle of the streets.
Wow.
And in protest of their protest, he just let all of the ashes be and left the doors open to his house and said, if you think that my value is in these material possessions, you have another thing coming.
Wow.
So they slept on the floor because they burned his bed, and then he got up every day to go fight slavery. Still, it's like, dude, what else left is there going to burn? Me?
Right. So, wow. Okay. You know, it's refreshing to hear this because I think a lot of us, and for a good reason, obviously evangelicalism is not known for that today. And there's a long, I mean, that's one of those, like, it's a 4-part episode, you know, like part one, part two, there's so much there. Right.
Yeah.
But it's at least in like these foundational moments, evangelicals were the rebels of the Christian tradition in America. Yeah. They were not favored. They were not looked highly upon.
Right.
The establishment really thought they were problematic, right? Talk about Oberlin College, though, because I remember reading in the book, I'm like, this college is just, they're breaking all the rules. I think the book says that they were the first in America to ordain women, which was like unheard of, you know, and also, you know, they would use their money and their funding for the Underground Railroad. Give me some more details about Oberlin.
Yeah, so Charles Finney had a huge impact on Oberlin. I think he served as their president for a time, if I'm not mistaken. But it was his convictions that really shaped Oberlin to be a fountain of activism. And I know that they have a relationship with the founder of Wheaton College, who was also a radical evangelical reformer. So look into the founder of Wheaton College as well, because that founder was just as what we would call radical today as Charles Finney and some others of his.
Yes,
day.
That's right. They were kind of like almost linked together, I think. I think the guy from Wheaton helped kind of fund Oberlin at one point, if I'm not mistaken.
Right. Yeah. And so Oberlin kind of became this fountainhead for activists. Like, their student body would be known for holding protests. They would be known for getting arrested for literally taking slaves and their families off of plantations at their own expense.
Wow.
In the midst of the semester, right? Right.
Dang.
They were the first ones to be like, they had no problem admitting free Black people to their school. They had no problem with interracial dating. They had no problem with the sexes talking to each other, like just breaking all sorts of social norms in that day.
Right.
And they became this fountainhead for leading the way in academic circles, this evangelical reform movement. It was just a fountainhead for that. And its place on the Underground Railroad cannot be understated. It did such prominent work in that endeavor.
So
for the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Mike Rowe here with a few thoughts on my favorite sweatshirt, a classic zip-up hoodie that used to be navy blue but has since faded to what the fashionistas call a distressed indigo. It's 13 years old, soft as a flannel bathrobe, and after a few hundred dirty jobs, demonstrably and undeniably indestructible. This is the kind of sweatshirt girlfriends like to permanently borrow, but I've held on to this one because I got it from American Giant. American Giant makes all their stuff right here in the USA, so they can control every link in their own supply chain. That matters, because when you buy American Giant, you not only get great quality, you create jobs for people in factory towns all over the country. No pressure, but if you give a damn about the business of making things in America, you got to support the companies who are doing it right. Go to American-Giant.com/Mike to get 20% off your first order. That's American-Giant.com/Mike.
I believe, again, from what I've read, and I have not read as much as you have, these new evangelicals, for lack of a better, or I guess old evangelicals, you know,
sure,
they were also very pious. Like, the book talks about how, you know, they wouldn't drink alcohol, they wouldn't even drink coffee. Like, they were very, they would wear very simple clothing. They were, they were extremely devoted. In ways that I think for me right now would almost kind of trigger me, you know, like, right? Oh my God, you know, like I'm trying to come out of this, you know, I would label it fundamentalism. To them, they labeled it radicalism, right? So can you kind of talk about that kind of, for me, it lives in two different camps, this idea of like they're super pious individually while also fighting for social justice issues.
But
to them, it was like, yeah, they're one of the same. Break that down for me.
Absolutely. Well, let me answer your question with a question. When you look at Shane Claiborne's crazy outfits, this pants especially, what do you think?
Radical. I love the dude. I'm challenged. I'm like, should I start making my own pants? Like, that is a good point, Ben, because if Shane Claiborne's like, in devotion to Jesus, I don't drink coffee, I'd be like, should I stop drinking coffee?
You know, coffee is what I take issue with because he brews it.
Of course. Got to throw the dad joke in there.
Right. God brews it all the time. Yeah, I think that's such an important trademark. So let me just give you a little personal tie-in with that.
Yeah.
I was educated in the Church of the Nazarene, and that's one of their like cardinal convictions is in abstaining from alcohol. And there's several other evangelical denominations that abstain from alcohol, but that's because they were founded during the Prohibition era or during times like the Great Awakening, right? Yeah. And the reason why, like, you would hear them talk about not smoking, like, and being involved with tobacco, don't drink alcohol, don't dance, don't go to speakeasies and play cards.
Right.
Like, all of these things, don't wear plain clothing, don't wear jewelry. Well, during the 50s and 60s, the Church of the Nazarene became this place where they would ask women to put all of their jewelry in the tithing plate as it went by, as a way of saying how holy and pure they are in the presence of God.
Wow.
Which is completely opposed to like the convictions of early evangelicals. Or alcohol, for example, they would demonize people who would drink alcohol just because of the substance itself rather than what that substance represented. Hmm. So early evangelicals, what their stance was, we are not going to participate in the tobacco industry, not because of tobacco, but because of what it's doing to the poor. We're not going to participate in the alcohol industry because of what alcohol industry is doing to the poor. We're not going to go watch movies because it's a waste of time. It takes us away from serving the poor. We're not going to go gamble and play cards because it takes our resources away from what? Serving the poor. So they were radicals in that every single part of their life, their economy, their spirituality, their thought life had to be devoted to making the world a better place, especially for the poor, the oppressed, and the marginalized.
I hope the audience out there has their jaw dropped at that, because to be honest with you, that makes so much sense now, but for decades, I just thought about it as legalism, you know, like, that's kind of what it morphed into, like you said, in the 50s and 60s and so on. So, but to think about it in like, no, the industry is immoral. The industry is oppressive, you know, therefore I will resist, right? As a way of protest almost.
Sure.
It brings about this like, I'm going to use Christian words out there, friends, so don't get triggered too hard, but it brings about this like countercultural idea, right? Like, oh, no. If the culture is mega everything, more stuff, cheap wages, cheap labor, we want to buck that narrative, and we will start by doing a full inventory of how our body presence contributes to that system, and if it does, we want to stop it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and I think what you're hitting on there is so important, because as time went on, sin became, in Christian circles, especially old school Calvinism, and I'm not dinging on all Calvinists, just this old school historical Calvinism.
Just Mark Driscoll, old school Calvinist, right?
Old school Princeton Calvinism of the time. As time went on, and especially as fundamentalism came into the scene, we have sin moving from a societal curse over the world since the fall, like Charles Finney would understand it, to save people from, to an individual responsibility. So smoking, dancing, drinking alcohol, that became the remnants of personal individual sin rather than the byproducts of society sinning together. Right. And oppressing the poor, which is much more of what Jesus would see as sin. Like his first sermon, and I can't get enough of his first sermon. His first sermon in the tabernacle, he took the scroll of Isaiah and he said, "Behold, the Spirit of the Lord is upon me to bring good news to the poor, to set captives free, to liberate the oppressed, to bring about the year of the Lord's favor," which is Jubilee, which is redistribution of wealth, and to bring sight to the blind. And he's like, "Today it is fulfilled in your midst." And they tried to stone him.
All like, I hear is Marxism.
Marx. Exactly. But that's really the mission of these early evangelicals, that they wanted to see people restored and saved from the sin that was devouring the culture around them.
Talk to me about how this evangelical movement impacted the church. Like, I know that for them, slavery was like the issue, right? It was like, listen, we can see it as plain as day. This is immoral. It's unbiblical. And a lot of churches, like I'm thinking about the Methodist Church, you know, I think that they kind of were founded off of abolitionism. Yeah. And then they kind of went back the other way because of what's the term where people can buy their pews? They can like pay to buy pews.
Oh yeah,
he talks about that in the book.
I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, and then the Methodist Church essentially said, "Well, we can get more wealthy people in here to make more money." And then there was a big split. Oh, can you kind of bring us through some of this, like how the evangelicals were impacting even church culture?
Yeah, there's two themes I think I'd want to touch on with that. One, with every reform movement, just like with what we're talking about with like smoking, drinking, and some of those social mores.
Yeah.
With every reform movement, those who you're liberating become lifted up, right?
Yes, right.
They actually become part of the middle class then, right? So those that you have liberated actually want to keep their their newfound freedoms, their newfound rights. And what can happen if a movement isn't careful, then they can start to demonize the very people that they were for, which is the poor and the oppressed, as if they are a threat to the resources they've found, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So like then the next generation wants to take care of their babies. They don't smoke, they don't drink. So they feel like they have all of those boxes checked. Yeah. Now they just want to live a quiet, peaceful, private life.
Right.
And so movements can tend to go that direction if they're not careful and get involved in things like bringing in more wealth and money to maintain that status quo. And then they become part of the problem. They right. become part of the people that perpetuate that status quo that, again, demonizes the poor and the oppressed.
Right. And we see that even like in the biblical narrative with the Jewish people, right? They go from being the oppressed to then becoming the oppressor. That's one of the big, it's like, it's a cycle almost in life that everyone has to be careful of because it's easy to do. But, you know, as far as like these evangelicals, so now like this radical faction is breaking out, it's gaining some traction, they've Oberlin College. How is it affecting the church though? Like, how is it affecting like church denominations at the time? Are these evangelicals starting their own, you know, denominations, or are they kind of infiltrating what's there and saying, you know, we want protests here, we need to fight and we need to take a stand? What is the dynamic at play?
Sure. I would say the early roots, the word evangelical is difficult to define as a like denomination. Like we would define a denomination as people around a certain sect of creeds, right?
Yeah.
Evangelicalism is inherently defined as a movement in these early days, right? So like where a denomination may be evangelical, they may not necessarily be Wesleyan or Calvinist in theology, right? But they do want to evangelize and shape the culture around them. Hmm. And that's really the defining trademark, is to preach the gospel, no matter where you're coming from, to transform society around you. And so that's really how it's impacting the churches. It's actually influencing church doctrine moving forward. So like the Wesleyan holiness movement, the Arminian movement, they became very centralized in, we want to radically transform society and liberate the poor, be there for the oppressed and the marginalized. And so the Methodists were really on the forefront of that and were really impacted by that sort of movement. Whereas more of the Reformed movements, like in the South and things like that, took kind of the opposite approach to that. And so the Methodists over time evolved into the middle class, the rich middle class, and then movements like the Church of the Nazarene broke off from them because they became the wealthy and they wanted to have radical love for the poor. But now we're seeing the Church of the Nazarene move in that direction, right? So it ebbs and flows throughout history, but that evangelical reformation spirit is what we need to be looking for, right? Mm. What we need to be looking for to revive. And I think that's what you're talking about with new evangelical, is you want to be the new reformers, perhaps from the evangelical movement we've inherited, to reclaim that spirit of evangelical reform.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's why I always say, well, not always, but it's in my bio, you know, we're learning backwards to go forwards. Like if we can look back throughout history, we see that what is deemed radical today is not radical at all. There's actually a rich evangelical tradition of people who were bucking the trend from the beginning and had their people calling them divisive and evil and whatever the slurs were for their day, they had them. And they said, we don't care. You know, like this is more important. And I think that's an interesting correlation because obviously, I mean, and again, for the listeners out there, I'm sure a lot of them are listening being like, wait, that's the evangelical heritage, because all they think about are the past maybe, you know, 6 to 10 years with Trump and the insurrection. And now things are getting just worse and worse as far as the CRT boogeyman, you know, system that has been, as we've seen from conservative evangelicals, intentionally manufactured. That's actually words off, you know, from their own tweets. And so a lot of us are like, well, I guess what I'm saying, Ben, is that I can understand why people would say, I want nothing to do with evangelicals. Right. Like, I get it. I do. Yeah. Right. But if we can like dig through the dirt and find that diamond that's always kind of been there and bring that back and say, actually, these people were way more open. They were way more interested in the gospel in the social sense and also individual, but also social. Right. And they were funding it. And like you said, those really rich people, I forgot their names, you know, making tons of money and saying, how can we do good? How can we give it away? How can we fund, you know, things like that? That is, I think, just so attractive to me to want to bring back.
Yeah. And I think that's what makes it even like knowing that history is a two-edged sword, because like knowing that that's possible brings about so much pain in what we've abandoned and what is known as evangelicalism today. And I think like the Holy Post podcasts and resources like that, that are actually showing the distinctions between fundamentalism, neo-evangelicalism, and evangelicalism historically, it is so important, because once we know that identity, then we can know how to move forward and what we want to reclaim. Because I've seen so many, and I've seen tendencies in myself to where I just want to abandon it all. Like it doesn't feel like anything can be reclaimed, but history really helps to show that no, like a lot of our ancestors in the American context were actually embodying the faith that we really want, that we were actually taught to believe as kids growing up in the church.
Right.
And we want to see transformed in our culture today.
No, I totally agree. It's interesting because, you know, Charles Finney, I think he's kind of like one of the major founders of really charismatic or Pentecostalism, I guess a better way of putting it. And it's funny because now I have so many problems with Pentecostalism. And you know, like he started the altar call. That was really his thing. These very emotional revivals. And Charles was very open about it. I mean, he would say, I'm using the senses, right? I'm using emotion. I'm using my voice to well up someone's emotions to come to Christ. So it's not like he was hiding it and saying, that's the Holy Spirit. It was very transparent. Right. Like, no, we're using emotions here. And so it's hard for me to kind of reconcile these two things, because on one hand, I'm like, man, Finney, you sly dog, you rebel, you know, just sticking it to those Calvinists. But on the other hand, I'm like, but Finney, the foundation you laid gave us people like Sean Foyt.
I know.
And I'm just like the AG, right? And it's tough, because I think the reason why it's important to have these conversations is because it's easy just to make things so black and white, right? It's easy to say, oh, Charles Finley was awesome, or he was terrible. And the answer is probably somewhere in between. Like, he did so much good. You know, as far as I know, he had no scandal. He wasn't abusing women, right? But also some of the foundational stuff he laid down kind of birthed some problems later on. But that's everyone has that, right? Like every movement is going to have things that are going to get critiqued and changed.
Right. One of my favorite podcasters to listen to besides you.
thank you.
Is Aaron Mankey. I don't know if you have listened to any of this stuff.
I don't.
He's historical, but he does podcasts that are on the intersection of the historical and the dark. So he covers a lot of spiritualism in his podcast called Unobscured. He has a great podcast called Lore, but he looks at the movement of religion in American life and beyond as well. It's really good. But one of the things that he says all the time about history is that we like to try to like separate and bifurcate history into really easy digestible segments, but it's really a snarled knot, like in wood, you know, all of these things that are intertwined. Nothing's really great. Nothing's really bad. There's incredible things that happen, but it's also tied to some really terrible things too.
Right.
And so understanding the nuances of history, it helps us to understand the nuances today.
No, you're right. I'm even thinking about the book Anti-Intellectualism in American Life, right? The author rips the Finneys of the World a new one. I mean, he's just these guys were anti-intellectualists. And so I read that book first, or I read part of it. Yeah. I'm like, oh, these charismatics, look at their foundation. It's all just stupidity, right? And then I read in Discovering an Evangelical Heritage that Finney's like anti-slavery and egalitarian. Yeah. I'm like, Finney's awesome. So I think that just like shows, depending on what lens you're looking through, it's nuanced, it's complicated, it's not always as clean as we want to make it. So let me ask you this. We had about 15 minutes left, and you know, I know that there's so much more to it, and I'll put that book in the show notes. It's such a good book for anyone who wants an easy read. It's like all the good stuff in like 110 pages. I mean, anyone could read it. It's super readable. In like a big picture, you know, view for you, Ben, how do we end up here? Like, how do we go from point A? Now, I know from what I can gather, the Enlightenment has something to do with it. The fundamentalist movement of like this biblical literacy, literalcy.
Literalism. You know? Yeah.
Yeah, literalism. Kind of comes into play of like, no, we have to compete with the scientific mind. So the Bible's our scientific textbook, you know?
Right.
I mean, what are some of like the big highlights of kind of how we ended up with like this evangelical movement now?
Yeah, I think that's such a needed and important question, because like, how do we get from the Charles Finney being called evangelical in his day to like the religious right, like what we've been seeing recently
in
Christian culture? And I would say there's a few factors there. One, with the old school Calvinism and how that morphed throughout time and grew into a huge movement that's still today. Fundamentalism is a huge part of that as well. But I think one of the biggest things, two big things I want to highlight before we get before we're done.
Okay.
One is that they had this vision of reforming American society pre-Civil War. And after Civil War, they saw the women's suffrage movement. They saw the abolishment of slavery. They saw all of these things kind of coming to fruition. And yet they realized, it's almost soberingly, that it's much more difficult than they ever thought possible. Like, even though slavery is abolished, in swoops in the Ku Klux Klan and like Jim Crow laws and all these things. And so they became less convinced that their utopia could actually be realized, right?
Yeah.
And they are inheriting wealth, and their society is becoming more industrialized, and all of these factors that kind of make Christianity more of an institutionalized. And they had just fought so hard pre-Civil War to become like to have this utopia realized, and they got the wind knocked out of their sails overall. And yet Black people were still suffering. Women still didn't have the right to vote. Like, all of these things were still not yet realized, right?
Right. And if you're seeing the Industrial Revolution happen, you're seeing crazy labor, you're seeing kids being worked to death, right? So you're probably seeing almost maybe comparatively like another ugly side of humanity, where you're like, wait, we worked so hard, and now this monstrosity is right in front of us.
Right. And talk about being so convinced that that could be realized and then seeing that happen.
Yeah.
Right. That's going to have a major impact on your theology. And then in the smack dab in the middle of that, like Civil War, all of these legislations, right in the early 1900s, they hear this narrative of this guy named John Darby, who got his head knocked off riding a horse, was held up sick, and had this new vision of scripture where it wasn't just people that were called to embody the kingdom of God as the church, but as actually nations. And America was the chosen nation for God to embody his presence on the world. And he coined this phrase called the rapture during that time. And this
really?
Is this is when premillennialism just invades Christianity.
Yes. Yes.
And so beforehand, Charles Finney, Wesleyans, they're all post-trib, where they believe that they are making the way for the Lord. So they need to make society great. Like, the poor need to be set free. Captives need to be liberated. The oppressed need to be sanctified and brought out of their oppression. Whereas pre-trib, they believe, well, all the saints are going to be raptured anyways, and Jesus is going to come back and destroy all of this.
Right.
And so they become much more focused on sin and evil as signs of the end, rather than being signs of the end themselves and liberating the oppressed and the marginalized. And so, like, dispensationalism just takes over the American scene and transforms evangelicalism in some irreparable ways.
Let's pause there for a second.
Okay.
I forgot about that. Very big, like,
huge.
You know, like
you
glacier detail,
that.
Right?
Yes.
Like that moment shifted in the minds of Christians what it means to be a Christian, right? Well, the world, almost this, the sense of the world has to get worse and worse. And the worse it gets, the closer we are to the return. Right. As opposed to, no. As we prepare the way for the Lord and we liberate, right? And we become like reflections of Jesus on earth, that ushers in, you know, the coming age. And that detail we have inherited, and it's silent. A lot of us don't know where it comes from, but you're absolutely right. Darby is the catalyst for that huge shift that has really gave the fruit of that has been the Left Behind series. It's been this idea.
Planet Earth, horrible thing.
Yes, and I would even say it has now contributed to anti-global warming, you know, folks. No, it's not true. You know, it's just a big globalist, you know, whatever, you know, conspiracy.
Right.
And it's because things have to get worse and worse, and that's just proof. Well, God's coming back any day.
I had somebody quite a bit ago tell me that even if global warming is true, good. Because it means the destruction of the planet is more imminent, which means Christ's return is close. So like the signs of the ends are wars and rumors of wars and all of these horrible things, the plagues and all of this stuff. They take those as like, this is a good sign. Jesus' return is imminent, rather than trying to reform society to make it look more like the kingdom Jesus is bringing here.
Right. No, you're so right. It's literally ass backwards. I mean, how else can you say it? It is. It's totally topsy-turvy. All right. So you have that moment, and then continue on. I'm listening.
So you have that huge moment, and that's really like fundamentalism. It shoots out of dispensationalism as well. And like, it just has like, again, that snarled knot. It's got its tentacles into everything. And as you go through the, like, you have this massive anxiety again, that John Darby is looking at, the sinking of the Titanic, the brewing of World War I, like all of these things lead to what many scholars are calling a third Great Awakening, but it's not positive. Like dispensationalism is this new spiritual fervor where preaching changes. When you think that the rapture is imminent, your preaching of the gospel is to save their soul for Jesus to rapture them, rather than taking care of any of their societal ills. Like you don't care that people are in poverty because that's a sign that the end is coming. You need to save their soul, which is the most prominent thing.
Right.
So that Jesus can rapture them. Whereas this other movement continued forward, like with the Salvation Army and a couple of other movements, where they're still trying to take care of the welfare of the people because they want it to be a reflection of Christ's kingdom.
Right. That's where we hear that idea. Well, better someone, you know, have a little bit of suffering now, and in the afterlife be in bliss forever than the opposite, right? Almost like this idea of like they're somehow opposed. Like someone's, you know, theoretical or potential spiritual destination is at odds with whatever their lot in this life is, and we can't try and fix both, right? Or what they'll say is like, well, if we feed people and they burn in hell forever, like, is that really important? And it's like, wow, what a twisted theology.
So twisted.
At the same time, you can see how when you grab certain verses and grab certain, you know, perspectives and you weave this new quilt, how it can make sense, right? But you have to weave it a certain way.
Absolutely. I agree. I think one of the threads of that quilt is one of the negative byproducts of seeing slavery abolished and women gaining more rights, the poor getting further ahead in society, is that they kind of believed that many Christians believed that America became more Christian, which rightly so, right? People were getting more rights. There was equitable resources, sharing of goods and things like that. And yet to believe that it's been achieved propagates this myth that we believe deeply today that America is Christian or has always been Christian, which is a worse myth, right?
Right.
And so that's why you see evangelicals now trying to keep America Christian. Keeping prayer in school is a huge thing. Making sure marriage is kept a sacrament in the legality of our government.
Right.
Making sure that sanctity of life is protected by the government rather than advocated for by the church. And downplaying like government being a helper to the poor. Like, no, that's the responsibility of the church. You just legislate our morality because we need to keep our culture Christian,
right.
which is which is just a myth from these gains that we did in a good way, like bringing about the abolition of slavery and giving, like making sure women have the right to vote and women's suffrage, all these things that we led. We can't like say, oh, we accomplished those things, and now we just need to keep the status quo. You see that keeping the status quo there comes from some of these small victories that we had in the past.
Wow. Wow. Yeah, it's really amazing how everything is super linked together, you know, and it, like you said, it's really, it's just convoluted. It's convoluted and it's messy. And, you know, like you said, we have like all these, we have these like big moments, right? You have the Derby and the Rapture stuff. Then you have the Jerry Falwell's kind of, you know, make a big deal with fighting desegregation, right? And that's when Jerry Falwell starts his own school, like right when that kind of thing happens. And and you know, again, I want to kind of circle back to full circle here. History has, as Jamar Tisby says, the receipts. Like it shows you, hey, this is kind of how we got here, and these are some pivotal moments, and we shouldn't repeat them. But what I'm afraid of more and more, Ben, to be honest with you, you know, I used to think like, you know, a couple of years ago, man, like, well, it's 2015, it's 2018, it's 2020. We progressed, and I think in a lot of ways, the religious right has digressed almost more than it has in a long, long time.
I agree.
You know, I'm just seeing who they support, the books that they produce, this us versus them, this war mentality, this you know, easily gullible, believable conspiracy theory foundational group of people that the evangelical church will not call out, right? They're too busy calling out CRT, which we know is such a boogeyman anyway. It's so misdefined intentionally. And they really give homage to people that I'm like, these people are really, they're not for their neighbor. They're not for, you know, the oppressed and the poor. They're really for keeping white power ultimately. So it's discouraging to see, like, we're kind of coming back around that circle of like, wait, in 50 years from now, I don't know if we're going to look back and be too fond of what Christianity was doing in 2021.
Absolutely. I've been an advocate for a while now, especially since 2020, that evangelicalism, and really statistics are showing that that's dominantly a white movement now.
Yeah.
It's like reading Jamar Tisby, like you've got to read his work of like The Color of Compromise.
So
like,
good.
That book is just so eminent in this conversation.
Totally.
Because it also shows the dark side too of movements like the Great Awakening and stuff like that. So that's really important. But yeah. I think what I've been advocating is that evangelicalism needs to be marked and seen as its own religion and political movement. Like it is not part, it has its own identity. It has its own like funders. It has its own creed that's plastered everywhere, all over the news and social media. Like it is its own separate movement now. And to be able to put distance between people who are trying to authentically live out their faith, like I am a Wesleyan Arminian. Like I don't call myself an evangelical. Wow. Until that term is reclaimed, and like it's hard enough calling myself a pastor in society, let alone like a Christian or an evangelical, right? Like,
yeah,
I saw a great caveat the other day. It's like I am a Christian, but I'm the love thy neighbor kind, not the from the capital kind, right?
Right. It's a fair point.
You have to add those caveats.
It's a because there are Christians doing it. I mean, we saw Christian flags in the freaking. Well, I'm not going to argue that, but you understand. Right. So.
Yeah. But so, like, making that distinction, like, I do deeply believe that the religious right has evolved into its own religion now, and it's a civil religion. It's a religion of nationalism. It doesn't have much like any sort of resemblance of early historic traditional Christianity.
Right.
And it is only concerned with power and control in the name of Jesus, right? They're using Christ's name to galvanize that. And I think being able to just say that out loud and say, okay, like, just be honest. You are your own religion with your own gods. And we are trying to set ourselves apart as a distinct people to move towards loving our neighbor and being this embodiment that our evangelical forerunners really laid out for us.
You know, I got to be honest, Ben, I've been thinking a lot about that personally. Like, at what point do I just say, I don't think, you know, conservative evangelicalism is a valid Christian movement. I mean, I know that, and I don't want to sound divisive, and I believe in good faith conversations, and I want to talk to those people. I would love to have Vadi Bachman on, you know, talk to him about his book, Fault Lines, you know? But, like, the more I read those guys, and I see what they're tweeting, and I see what they're writing, and I see what their base is saying, and who they're supporting, and who they like, the more I'm like, guys, I mean, I don't know, man. Like you're just so far from even just a surface level, non-contextual reading of Jesus. Forget putting him in his context, right?
Right.
And I wrestle with that because I you know, the new evangelicals were committed to good faith conversation, and we want more seats at the table. And I try to balance this tension of, like, where do you draw a boundary, right? But also, like, welcome people's different perspectives if they want to engage respectfully. And I don't have an easy answer for that, but I say that because I really empathize with what you said, because, I mean, when people are supporting and sending and sharing people like Candace Owens, I've seen pastors share Candace Owens or share Tucker Carlson.
Right.
I'm like, what? Again, I feel like we're in the Twilight Zone. What faith? What Jesus are we following to where you as a pastor feel like sharing Candace Owens or Tucker Carlson, you know, is a wise representative of what you stand for?
Sure.
I really wrestle with that big time, you know, I really do.
Yeah, I think that's one of the reasons why I really want to advocate, like, making this distinct, because I really want to advocate for nuance here, right? And so, like, some people will say all liberals believe this. Well, that's not necessarily true, right? And I don't necessarily think of the religious right as traditional conservatism either, right? So, like,
totally agree.
Right. And so, like, my conservative friends, who I think are very thoughtful and very articulate and are wrestling with what that movement has done to the word conservative, even, and like to their ideas of Christianity as well. And so I think reclaiming that nuance is what you're talking about, bringing people to the table to where, like, let's find thoughtful conservatives to, like, say, yeah, I really don't like what that extremism is doing either. We've got to find a break. Richard Rohr did an incredible work. I don't know if you've read that, Sins of Conservatives and Sins of Liberals.
Oh, I haven't.
From Richard Rohr. It's mind-blowing. I'll send it to you later.
Yeah, send it over to me.
It's mind-blowing. And I think one of those things is to be really honest with the discrepancies of our own movement. Like, we are all functioning under one heresy or another at every moment, right?
Right.
And the moment we're honest with that, I think is the moment we are able to protect ourselves from extremism. Because it's like, we don't want to go down the extremist path. Right now, we're dealing with a religious right problem.
Yeah.
Like a religious far right problem.
Yeah.
We don't have a religious far left problem in American Christianity.
I agree. Right? Totally.
There isn't one. And so until we have that, then we can tackle that. But we're so fearful of a religious left problem traditionally that we kind of give religious right problems a pass. And so we've got to be honest with what we're defining here and what nuances we want to really be faithful to.
Ben, I couldn't have said it any better. I totally agree with you. I tell the account and the followers all the time, like, we're not trying to be fundamentalists of the other side. That's easy. Yeah. It's easy to paint things in black and white. We have to live in the tension, and we have to be willing to reform ourselves and to recognize when we're wrong. But like you said, I'm utterly convinced we don't have a far left problem in Christian thinking. We have a far right problem.
Yeah.
And if we had a far left problem, if I had people, I you know, what I say is, if I had people waving a Biden flag on the back of their truck saying "In Biden we trust," you know, I'm telling people from the pulpit how great Joe Biden is, how he's saving America. I'd say, you got a problem, dude. You know, like, I am not.
That's nationalism again.
I do not identify as a progressive, as liberal. Yeah, do I have some progressive thoughts? Do I have thoughts that might line up in that camp? Yeah, for sure. But make no mistake, I'm not bowing the knee to the Democratic platform. Like, I don't care about the Democratic platform. I care about how are we, you know, modeling and reflecting Jesus well. And if if that language I use happens to, in the spirit of the age, to line up with a certain political party and they want to work with me, phenomenal, because I want to work with you as well. But if it doesn't, then I'm going to speak up against it. You know, bottom line. So,
yeah.
Absolutely. Anyway, Ben, it's great stuff, man. You know, I appreciate you coming on. I know that we really just flew people over the iceberg. we didn't even like touch the surface of this thing. Right. You know, there's so much more to talk about, but I think for now people can really chew on this. I know one of the resources is Discovering an Evangelical Heritage. Any other books or resources you recommend for kind of, you know, learning more about our history?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, so like Donald Dayton actually came up with a follow-up that I think is so incredible for Discovering an Evangelical Heritage. He also wrote Rediscovering an Evangelical Heritage, which is so incredible. So that book for sure. The one that we've already mentioned by Jamar Tibbsy, The Color of Compromise. Ibrahim X. Kendi, from the beginning, really shows how pivotal American Christianity was in the slavery movement, the abolition of slavery. Doesn't really highlight a lot of evangelical traditions, unfortunately, but it does give you an incredible backdrop of the theological movements of the time.
Yeah, you're right.
Anti-intellectual, anything really that Richard Hofstetler writes. He has some incredible, he's a Pulitzer Prize winning author, but he wrote the anti-intellectualism in American life. But he also wrote some incredible things about paranoia in American politics and the influence of that in religious life as well. Jesus and John Wayne by Tristan Dumez. Like that is probably the most recent work on where evangelicalism is today.
Yeah.
And so I would give those things a start, and then we can take a deep dive into reading the actual like reformers themselves, like Charles Finney, reading their actual works, like Charles and John Wesley, these figures that we hear about, but we don't really actually let them speak to us through their writings very
much. Awesome. And where can people find you, Ben?
Yeah, you can find me on Facebook, Ben Kramer, Instagram, Twitter. I have a blog that I write every now and then. So
awesome. Ben, thanks for making time. I know you're a busy man, but this was awesome. I can't wait for people to hear it.
Yeah, I love being with you, man. This was so, so great.
Awesome. Talk to you soon.
Talk to you soon.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.